It's a Cab Chat interview.
Where you're hearing things. Where you're hearing things.
Super Cabby Podcast, Episode 11. In this episode, I interview Steve McNamara, the General Secretary of the LTDA. I pose quite a lot of questions to Steve, and he answers them all very frankly and honestly and genuinely. It's quite a long interview. It goes on for about an hour and 20 minutes, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the interview. Right, I'm sitting here with Steve McNamara, who's the General Secretary of the LTDA.
That's right.
So, Steve, how long ago did you get your badge?
That's a long... 1986.
And how long did it take you to do the knowledge?
About just under 2 years.
So what made you decide to become a cab driver?
Same as everybody else, I suppose. I had family who were cab drivers, the cousin... who was a cab driver. One of my reasonably close friends was a cab driver. At the time, I was running a failing hire business with my ex-wife, and it seemed a logical thing to do.
So how long did it take you to do the knowledge?
Just under 2 years. I was doing it pretty much full-time. About 2 years.
So, and then you became an LTDA member, obviously.
Yeah, I hadn't been driving a cab long when I joined the LTDA. I could probably look it up on the system. That would have probably been 87, certainly within a year of getting a badge, reasonably quickly. Then I went on Comcab, and then I got sort of enrolled in politics through Comcab. At the time, as you know, the LTDA owned Comcab 100%.
Yeah.
And so all branch meetings, which were heavily attended at the day, were all about Comcab. It was that's the only point of discussion was Comcab.
So what made you decide to apply to go on the LTDA?
Well, I got a bit involved in the politics of Computer Cab at the time. I mean, this is all ancient history now. They were they put the subs up. They wanted to have it to call into ranks. And at the time, as somebody who used to like the not having ranks, the other radio circuits, as you know, Dialer Cab and Manview had fixed ranks then. You had to be on a physical rank, and Comcab never. And so that was the big sort of battle cry, if you like. So I got involved politically through that. And then because of that, someone asked me to stand as the branch chairman, because at the time, the person who was the branch chairman then was very much pro Comcab or Comcab management, and so I stood, and it was in a pub in Curtin Road. I'm trying to think of the pub's called, just off of Curtin Road. It was a very heated evening, to say the least, because the then management of Comcab, which was Jeff Cayley and the board, he actually told me, you know, you've got no chance, you won't get on, I'll make sure you don't get on. And you know, I was one of those bores that kept stopping people on cab ranks. Every time I went on a rank, you know, I was getting out and or doing a two cab job on Comcab or pulling up outside a Comcab account. I was telling everybody what was going on, and most guys, 99% of the guys, just weren't interested. But surprisingly, we won the day. I managed to get about 40, 45 people there. They only managed to get about two or three less. And then we had the vote, and I won, and I was the branch chairman.
So Jeff Cayley was opposed to you becoming the
branch chairman? Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, and for the first 2 years, I used to... it was different those times of day. When the LTDA used to own Computer Cab, it was very much a case of the towel wagging the dog.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, the LTDA owned Comcab.
It seemed the other way around.
It was certainly the other way around. I mean, all the top positions were held by computer cab people, and it was a constant state of war at the COM, all over Comcab, the way it was being run. The management decisions, the financial decisions were made. It was a constant war.
So, obviously, Jeff Cady was opposed to you becoming a member of the committee. But how did the rest of the committee go with you?
All the Comcab people, they used to call them the Diving Club, what it was known as today, because Jeff and his mates used to belong to it. They had a Comcab Diving Club. And those were the people that used to turn out to the elections. You know, he used to phone all his mates up and get them to come to the elections. So the Diving Club didn't speak to me. And you know, I could have said the sky was blue and I would have got shouted down. It was... I only had one ally on the COM at the time. Well, I had two allies. There was Steve Van Gelder.
Yeah.
They called him the judge, as you know. I had a judge who... And they used to make him leave the room because he left Comcab and went on Diacab. And they used to make him stand outside the moment anything was discussed on Comcab. He was my main anti-Comcab ally, and Bob Oddie, who was always the LTDA man and not the Comcab man, although he was at the time would have been seriously outvoted. He was the other conspirator in a gang of three, if you like.
Because, of course, when you joined the LTDA, there was only the LTDA or the TGWU at the time, wasn't there?
Yeah, it never occurred to me to join the union. And my politics have always been a little bit left of centre. But, as I say, I just joined the LTDA because I thought it was more specific, taxi trade association, union, if you like. And then I got dragged into the politics of the other Comcab.
Yeah. So you didn't have an easy ride to start with, then, so you could...
No, far from it. It certainly wasn't an easy ride. I mean, they tried all sorts of tricks to get rid of me back in the day. At one point, I used to rent a cab from Comcab. They had these, remember the Nelson cabs? Club class, they used to call it. Not the green ones, the ones before, they had the Nelson cabs.
The grey coloured ones?
No, they had the club class. Then they had the ones with London all over them as a map. And what happened, the way it used to work, when they first introduced them, you used to pay a week up front for the cab, and it was taken out yourself. So I can't remember the technicalities. It was a week up front and a week in arrears or something. I can't quite remember how it worked. But all of a sudden, they announced that they were changing it. And they said, we're now on a month up front. Now, so you imagine you're driving a cab and suddenly you're paying for it weekly or fortnightly. Suddenly you've got to pay a month up front. So I said, well, it's going to take a couple of weeks to get to that stage. At the time... I think it was about 150 quid a week. It was quite a lot of money then. And they went, yeah, that's fine, no problem. And they said to all the drivers, there was about 10 or 12 of us, we'll give you 4 or 5 months to get a bit in front, which is fine. Well, the very next COM meeting, we had an election, and they tried to tell me that I couldn't stand because I wasn't fully financial and because I owed the company money. And there was obviously a bit of a scream up over that. And they backed down on that one. But that was the sort of tricks they used to get up to back in the day.
Sorry. So, I mean, not having an easy ride, a lot of people may have quit to an interstate in the early years, but you stuck with it.
No, because I could always see that the radio circuit was totally separate from the LTDA, and I always wanted to separate from the LTDA. I understood why the people who formed Comcab saw it as the great fight back against minicabs. But very quickly, it had become a business, a very successful business at one point. And as much as, you know, I criticised Kayleigh and the boys, to be fair, at first they did an amazing job. You know, they really turned it from nothing into the biggest circuit in London in a very few years. The profits were great. Everything was really, really good on it. I mean, they made some big mistakes in the end, which is why we lost it.
But Movistar being one of them.
Well, Movistar was the one, wasn't it? It was Movistar that cost them the company. They made mistakes. I mean, everyone makes mistakes. They made mistakes, and unfortunately, the mistakes ran away from it.
I was told that they had no option to sell in the end.
They owed £7 million, I think. And what happened? We were liable for their debts as the parent company, the LTDA. The bank started literally knocking on the door, which was the first we knew of it. I was still only a branch chairman then. I wasn't really involved up here, but I remember coming to a COM meeting and being told, I think it might have been Harry Fagan at the time, telling us that, you know, we needed to raise some phenomenal sum of money, and he wanted to remortgage the building, and they wanted to do this, and whoa, no, why are we doing that? They were doing that. And you could see that what had happened, they instead of buying a system off the shelf,
They tried to develop their own.
And as you know, we've cutting-edge software, I mean, you know you're getting involved in this app. Well, back then it was even more revolutionary. Yeah. GPS software was in its infancy. I think the Americans had just given everybody the right to use GPS. And they wanted to develop their own system, and it was really forward-thinking of them, you know, to be able to give you a going-home job because it knew where you were going and knew where it was. All real good stuff. But unfortunately, they never had the budget controls correct. They employed... the software people weren't really given a budget to work with. They were just sort of given a free rein. They were spending money they never had. They got very badly turned over by a software company who produced the software. And then when it found out it didn't work or it didn't do what they wanted it to do, the software company said, well, that'll be another £1 million to put it right. And the option then was, we'll take them to court, which will take 3 or 4 years. You may get your money back, you might not.
Or pay them more money.
So they had no choice but to pay them more money. They got badly burnt with that. And that will happen just at the start of one of the worst recessions.
Yeah.
Business took a dive. They weren't taking any money in. They were doing very badly. Their job figures fell. They were laying out money they never had. And the banks came a-knocking.
It's a shame, really, because, as you say, they built up a really good business to start with. And then...
Yeah, I mean,
pretty bad management, really. They got
it was bad management. They also got unlucky. They were unlucky. Just at the peak of their troubles and running up enormous debts. They hit a recession. I mean, it was bad luck. But having said that, those decisions shouldn't have been made. And because everybody says at the time, well, the CRM were really responsible. And I suppose we were. But as anyone who was on it at the time tells you, we were told very little.
You can only be responsible for the information you're given, really.
Well, perhaps we should have asked for more information. I think, you know, in hindsight, we should have done. I don't think at the time, the level of business that was involved, I don't think I would have understood it, to be honest with you. All about loans and gearing ratios. You could have taught yourself, but by the time I'd have done that, it was all too late. And also, we had accountants telling us it was all okay. We had auditors coming in and telling us it was all okay. And you tend to trust these professionals.
Yeah.
And it was all okay until the last minute when it all went wrong. Fortunately, we were able to sell it. The Singaporean bus company bought it. They took on all the debts. And it was gone. Very, very fortunate for them. I mean, almost as soon as they took it over, and it was literally within about a fortnight, the economy turned around, and they were seeing profits come back in. They invested the money necessary to get the software working, and it was a great success story.
But the LCDA retained a 20%...
Yeah, at the time, we retained 20% of ComCab. That was a tremendous result, really, because at the time, I mean, certain people in the cab trade offered us £1 for it, for computer cab, and whereas these people come in, let us keep 20%, took over the debts, as I say, which are substantial debts, certainly £6 or £7 million, took it over, and we retained 20% of it. That saw the separation, which is something I'd always wanted to see, between us and Computer Cab. And at the time, there was lots of people said, oh, well, you've only got members because of... You had to be a member of the LTDA to be able to
bring that up. Yeah.
And that deal was part of the deal that was in place. I think it was for 2 years afterwards. I'm not too sure. But of course, the reality was at that time of day, I think we had just under 6,000 members. And now we've got over 10.5 at the moment. And growing quite rapidly at the moment. We're putting on 500 to 600 members a year at the moment, net gain. Every year we lose people. Obviously, people die, people leave the trade, people leave us, people retire. But every month we have positive growth, and that was it. ComCab are gone, and the LTDA hasn't looked back since.
So when did the LTDA finally sell the 20%? Because I know it's now gone, isn't it?
Yeah, we sold the 20% about three. No, I see. Time flies. I mean, I'd have to look it up. It might be about 4.5 years ago, I guess. We sold it. We've been looking for the right time to sell for a considerable amount of time, probably 4 or 5 years. The market conditions at the time were deemed to be the right, and indeed they were. Had we sold them now, we'd have been lucky to realise probably a 20th of what we got for it at the time.
So moving on from then, you know, the LTA is now separate from Computercab, and as you say, the membership's growing and growing and growing. What do you put that growth down to, Steve?
Yeah, well, two things. Firstly, when Bob Oddie had the job, the first thing he did when he took over from Harry was to change the focus of the organisation. He made it much more member-focused, member-orientated. He concentrated on our strengths, which were representing drivers, which was providing legal services, and stopped doing what we weren't good at. And we weren't good at running businesses. We should never have got into it in the first place. Although, as I say, the intentions were right. But we're not businessmen. I don't profess to be a businessman. And so we concentrated on what we were good at. It took us a while to lose the image that the LTDA had. We had a very poor image in the trade. I mean, at one time, going back then, you know, the moment you went anywhere, people wouldn't. If you'd have had an LTDA badge on, it was very, very negative. Over the next 10 years, I mean, Bob turned it around. The image was much more positive. You've only got to look now at a number of diaries and windows and things. Someone would never have done that 10 or 12 years ago. It was a rebranding, if you like. We got that new logo. We went from that sort of shield that we had back in the day. We had this new logo, this new sort of image, and very, very slowly but steadily we built on that. We offer a walk-in one-stop shop. There's always someone to answer the phone. We've just employed another barrister come solicitor. We offer the best legal services in the trade, bar none. And anyone who tells you that's not the case is just wrong. The difference is most of the other groups in the trade, and this is not putting anybody down at all, they use insurance services. And the way that works is the insurance company take a premium, and then when you make a claim, they pay out, just like car insurance, just like anything else. We self-insure. We invest in our own solicitors, our own barristers that are on a wage, and we employ people who know the taxi trade, who deal with our members and our members only. They don't do any outside work. They only and the thing with our legal service, it's not done to a price, it's done to a standard. The best example that I can give you is one day last week we had an incident. A barrister came in, we've got a member who's unfortunately been involved in an accident, somebody's dead, and straight away we're down the police station. The guy's obviously in custody. We're down the police station, and the first thing they've asked for is they want me to authorise a post-mortem. We have our own post-mortem done in order so there's no doubt as to how a person died, unfortunate person died. And right from the very beginning, and it's a case, I might say money's no object, that's obviously money's, but it's done to a standard, not a price. Now, if you were phoning an insurance company up and you was currently sitting in the cell somewhere, and
there's a limit on to how much they spend.
And I don't think anyone's going to authorise a post-mortem straight away before you even know if you're going to be charged. Yeah. You just don't know. And the way it works is, when they do the post-mortem, you have somebody there, you don't do your own. So when the post-mortem's about to be done, then you have a pathologist there representing you to ensure that...
So they basically watch the post-mortem, the official post-mortem.
Yeah, it's a long time since I've sat in on a post-mortem, but they that's what we do. Those are the sorts of things we do. I frequently get letters from members who literally can't believe the levels that we go to. Not last weekend, the weekend before, 11 o'clock at night, the barrister's ringing me. He's in the back streets of Camberwell, looking at street lighting and things for an incident that happened there 4 or 5 months before. Guy's coming to trial, one of our members, and in order to be able to know what went on, he wants to be able to down there and see the street lights himself. You know, and he's down there at the same time of the year or same time of the year, 11 o'clock at night. He's looking at street lights, looking at CCTV, looking at what people could have seen. And if you think, if anybody thinks that you get that sort of service from an insurance company, you don't.
Can I just take you back a little bit, Steve? Because you said, you know, the LTDA is not good at running the business. There's been a lot of criticism recently of, obviously, we were just speaking about Epps. People have been saying, why didn't the LTDA get involved and have their own app built? I mean, is this the reason
That's the reason. I mean, running a business is one thing, and running the LTDA is something else. I mean, apps are not cheap, as you know, isn't it? But it's not a case of the money. The reality is there's plenty of people in the trade who run businesses and run them very successfully. I mean, there's been all this fallout with Halo. Get Taxi is still running a taxi only service. So what does anybody think that I'd have to employ somebody to do it? When I got invited down Halo a few months ago, I think they had about 120 people working there. I appreciate it's their worldwide headquarters, but it's still an awful lot of people there. I think Get Taxi employ about 25 people. So I've got to start an app, I've got to employ 25 people. I just don't think it's something that we should be doing. I'm more than happy to promote and support any apps. I know you're thinking of doing one. I know this Maxi one's just launched, and there's a London Taxi app is somebody else one is launching. More than happy to promote or support any of them, but it's just something I don't think we should be running. I'll give you some reasons why. You're on an app, whatever the app is, and there's some incident on a, the credit card bounces, or the passenger's sick and doesn't pay, all the things that happen on radio circuits. I've now got this member phoning me, asking me what I'm going to do about someone being sick in his cab at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. It's not something that, it's just, it's going to distract from what we do. I've got to employ a lot of people to do it. I've got to invest a lot of time and money into it. It's not something I really understand or we understand. So you're relying on people you're going to employ. I think I'm going to get more criticism for it when it goes wrong than I would for launching it. So you know, horses for courses.
So you were just saying you're getting phone calls at 11 o'clock at night. Are you, being a general secretary, are you basically on call 24 hours a day, Steve?
Yeah, I've never really kept office hours anyway, so yeah, I mean, people ring me all hours. I mean, after Cabtrade's got my phone number, unfortunately, and they all tend to ring it. Weird and wonderful hours of the night and day. But it just goes with the job.
I know until recently you were still regularly driving the cab, wasn't you?
Yeah, you know, as people say to me about driving a cab, I mean, this is very much a full-time job.
Yeah.
But I still make a point of getting out in a cab.
I know you get out on a Friday night sometimes.
Yeah, I still get out on a Friday night. I've still got a cab. I still get out on a Friday night. I normally don't get out of here till probably 6:30, 6. And I stop for something to eat. I very rarely get home any later than about midnight, 1 o'clock, only because I've been here since 7. What I was doing up until very recently was getting out on a Monday or Tuesday evening for 3 or 4 hours as well. And I'll tell you why I do it. Because it's amazing how quickly... I drive a cab full-time for 25 years, mainly at night. And you think, well, you pretty much know it all, you've seen it all, and you've done it all. And that's true of a lot of things.
It's amazing how quickly you forget things.
It's amazing how quickly you forget things. And it's stunning how quickly things change.
Yeah.
I mean, literally. And when I do go out in a cab now, I mean, even though it's only, 3 years since I stopped driving a cab, certainly the majority of the time, without the phone, I'm lost, because the number, I'm ringing my mates all the time. Where's this? Where's that? And in the end, it's the nerves that do it. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
But the reality is, you know, I still drive a cab. I like driving a cab. I've always liked driving a cab. You know, I love this business. People talk about the cab trade. I've always loved this business. I've always liked cab drivers. I've always liked the whole thing that goes with it, you know, the whole camaraderie. You know, and I know people tell me now that, you know, someone's always overtaken you with their light on, you pull out a lens. I can honestly say it's only ever happened to me once. I know I'm not driving a cab full time anymore, but I still get out there once or twice a week. It's only ever happened to me once. And I don't see it. All I ever see is the majority of guys, you know, are pretty much how they always were.
So basically, you're only going out in the cab now to keep your knowledge up to date and
keep
your hand in.
Yeah, and I'll tell you why, because if I don't, I get a lot of abuse. I mean, my wife drives a cab, her three brothers drive cabs, most of my mates are cab drivers, I've still got family that are cab drivers, and, you know, they all take the mickey out of me, oh, you wouldn't know this and you wouldn't know that, and I've always enjoyed driving a cab.
Yeah.
People say, Oh, you know, I've honestly always liked driving a cab. I've tried it always. I've tried coming out in the middle of the night and going home at lunchtime. Tried coming out at lunchtime. I've tried working the airport. I've tried split shifts. I've tried it all. And I've tried it all for long periods of time. But I always found myself drifting back to that sort of lunchtime, early afternoon start.
So about 12, 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. I always found that the best hours to work. I always found it the most profitable, the most enjoyable. People are better that time of the day. In the mornings, I always find everybody miserable.
Yeah.
And it's funny, over the years, you say how the cab trade's changed. I mean, mobile phones. You know, when I first started driving a cab, people used to talk to you. And you remember the old, used to take the stop out and slide the window back and talk to people. And you just tend not to get that now.
All you see now is a glow on their face from their mobile phone.
That's exactly right. Everyone's on. And you get two or three people in the cab all talking to each other. They're not. They're on their phone talking to somebody else. But so yeah, it has changed. And you know, but I've always liked driving a cab. I mean, you go out, you've got the radio on, you're listening to it, you're talking to people on the phone now. I mean, what's not to like?
But of course, since you've got this job, Steve, you've got your brand new Lexus parked outside.
Yeah, I've got a brand. Well, last week I was told I had a new Porsche, a new 4x4 Porsche.
Oh, right.
And very nice. I'm saving up for one of them. I mean, the reality is, this job pays quite well. It does pay quite well, but I'm no better off than when I was driving a cab.
And you haven't got a brand new Lexus.
I haven't got a brand new Lexus. No. I drive the. As I say, I've still got a cab. I like driving a cab. And money wise, okay. The good thing about this job is, you know, I do get holidays. I do get paid for when I'm on holiday, which is the big bonus.
Yeah.
But money wise, I'm probably worse off than I was driving a cab. Realistically, probably not much.
You're probably doing more hours as well. If you're up here during the daytime, you're on call on the phone and you're still going out in a cab a couple of nights a week to keep your hands.
Yeah, but I tend not to go out weekends now, whereas I used to work weekends. So, yeah, it's, you know, I'm not pretending. Don't get me wrong, I love this job. I like this job. I like dealing with cab drivers. I enjoy the political manoeuvring. I'm trying to think of the appropriate word. The political manoeuvring that goes on dealing with TfL and dealing with different politicians. The constant diggers and snipers in the cab trade are really the funny bit is, the majority of people who are telling me what to do are not LTDA members, never have been, and are not members of anything, but all telling me what I should do.
It's one thing I was just going to bring up, because when I came up here and we spoke last time, you was telling me an awful lot of things that I didn't know that the LTDA were doing, and not in the taxi newspaper, like the ex policeman you employ that are chasing up rickshaw bits and pieces with the local police stations and things like that, which I don't suppose a lot of the trade know what's going on, Steve.
Yeah, because a lot of stuff that's going on, the moment you print it in the paper, it defeats the object of it. You know, people say to me, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? I mean, a number of people tell me you should employ a lobbying firm. Well, if I employ a lobbying firm and tell everyone I'm employing a lobbying firm, it somewhat defeats the object, doesn't it? The whole idea of getting your message across is to get your message across without everybody knowing what you've done to get your message across, surely. I mean, it's, you know, things with the rickshaws, we've decided to go a bit public on that again. We've currently, the artwork's just come through now. We're just putting some posters up of the commissioner, Sir Bernard Hogan Howe. He made a comment on the radio a few weeks ago that he didn't think that he couldn't see anything illegal in electric rickshaws, and he's just blatantly wrong. So we're gonna put up a series of posters across town featuring him. We're putting them on the admin. We're doing a demo on the 24th of September. Mainly to do with TfL. TfL's.
Do we know where the demo's going to be yet?
Yeah, we're doing it in the same place, really, Trafalgar Square, Parliament Square, Whitehall. And people, once again, you know, the critics say, well, you should have it somewhere else. Well, we considered the Aldwych and we considered different places, but the reality is, why change the winning formula?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah, go on.
Go on. One of the things I thought last demo was the interviews that you gave and the interviews that Grant gave, on the whole, were really, really good. But a lot of the media got the wrong impression as to what we was demonstrating about.
Yeah.
And I thought it may have been a good idea to have a press pack or a media pack to give out to these people to say, look, there are all the facts. In case you're unsure of anything of what we're demonstrating about, it's all down in black and white there.
Right. Well, we did that. We had a press. We didn't have a pack. We had a sheet of all the points on. But what we quickly learned, or what we already knew, to be honest with you, Uber's a story. Us blocking up London because TfL, you know, are not issuing licences and not listening to us are next to useless. This isn't really a story. They want a worldwide story. So that's why that didn't really work. What we're going to do this time, in an effort to stop that happening, although I can't say it's not going to happen again, because the first thing the media are going to ask me when I get in front of the camera is Uber. I know what's going to come up. It's exactly, and I'll say all the same things, nothing to do with Uber, it's all about TfL, but they're still going to ask Uber questions. So what we've done this time, some cab drivers who suggested it, we're going to have some little hold-up banners on the day and some A3 that you can stick in the back window of the cab or on the window of the cab that are all about TfL, Transport for London, not fit for purpose, etc., etc., etc. So any footage is going to show these banners, any still for photos, unless they're carefully edited, they're going to show these. So it's very difficult to say we're demonstrating about Uber when everybody's holding up a banner that says TfL, not fit for purpose. But the media being the media, I guarantee the first interview I'm going to do is... What's happening with Uber, Steve?
I found it quite interesting. They said their downloads went up by 850% on the day.
Rubbish.
But there's nothing to say that they only had one download the day before.
It's absolute rubbish.
It's just a numbers game.
Yeah, I mean, Uber tried to get maximum publicity out of it. Obviously, we was fully aware that that would happen. One of the risks of doing the demo and mentioning Uber was that we would have given them publicity, but we took the view.
It's the same as any demo we do. They try to look an alternative view to use it against us.
We took the view that there's three types of people in London. There's people who only use black cabs, taxis. There's people who only use minicabs, and there's the majority of people which use a combination of the both. We took the view that anybody who was savvy enough to be using apps and you being a regular user of taxi and minicabs was already fully aware of Uber anyway. And the fact that we were demonstrating against them isn't going to make most people go out and download them. And even if they did see an upside in downloads, it would have been from people who don't use them. It would have just been from, you know, housewives sitting in, you know, Pimlico or somewhere who downloaded it.
Might be an occasional user.
I really never saw that downside to it, but it was a risk that we had to take. I think subsequently, if you look in the media now, Uber's profile has certainly took a dive. The number of complaints, online complaints, if you search Twitter for Uber complaints, there's tens of thousands. And I've also been contacted by quite a lot of members of the public. I was quite surprised, who are very, very pro-taxi. And we've got a little private army now of people, probably 40, 50 people, who now spend their time emailing TfL, emailing their MP, going to meet their MPs, and putting an enormous amount of effort in on our behalf, purely because that demo we did. So that was certainly beneficial.
Yeah. Obviously, when you took over as General Secretary, you took over from Bob Oddie, who'd been in the job for quite some time.
15 years, I think, Bob Oddie, 16 years.
And Bob's obviously on the GLA.
The board, he's on the board of TfL.
Yeah.
Which he gets routinely lambasted, it has to be said.
He comes under a lot of criticism within the trade.
Yeah.
Because a lot of cab drivers feel that it's a conflict of interest from him being on the board of TfL and also being employed by the LTDA. And a lot of people think he's silent when he's on the board. But you actually told me a totally different story the other day.
Anyone who thinks Bob is silent has never met Bob, right? Anyone who thinks that has never met him. The only reason he's not... The way it works at the GLA, on the main TfL board, he is not allowed to speak about taxis. Steve Wright, who's the minicab guy, he's not allowed to talk about minicabs. They're not allowed to talk. That's the rules. As crazy as it seems, they're not allowed to comment on anything to do with taxis. So the only time he sits on a couple of panels. One of them's a surface transport panel, which he can speak on occasions. The only reason that Bob's on TFL is initially when Ken Livingstone was the mayor, the trade was asked to put up a board member, and we all shied it. The LTDA, certainly Unite, and I believe the LCDC at the time, shied away from it. And it was a bit different then because Alan Fleming was running LCDC and an ardent Tory, as you know, and big supporter of Boris, wouldn't have anything to do with Ken. So maybe they never got offered a seat on the board, but certainly us and the union did at Unite. And we took it was a bit of a poison chalice, and we took the decision not to take it. Things changed a little bit when Boris got the job. We were concerned as to who would get on the board if we never. So Bob was offered it, and he took it. It certainly wasn't something that he relished or wanted at the time. It has certainly been beneficial to us on numerous occasions with different things that have been going on, where he's able to talk to other board members. But I mean, it's this myth that Bob's this sort of quite shy, quiet, retiring type. Is to anyone who knows him, I mean, it's just laughable.
You did tell me about an incident with Leon Daniels, where Leon Daniels was speaking about something to do with taxis on the Surface Transport Committee, and you said Bob absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, Leon was going on the Service Transport panel about Uber being a smartphone. And of course, obviously, we've got an Uber smartphone. Of course, Bob was able to sort of, you know, wave it across the table and ask Leon to make a phone call on it, because you can't make a phone call. It's not a smartphone. It is an iPhone, but it's not capable of making telephone calls or sending texts. It works purely on Uber. And of course, he was, you know, he was able to ask Leon, you know, to make a phone call on it. You know, you can get the downloads for all this. Anyone who knows him, I mean, it just suits certain people to keep spouting it. And but as I say, the reality is, we're putting on 500 or 600 members a year. So it's the chatter in the elite in the cab trade who get all wound up about that. You know, the vast majority of people don't even know about it.
I think the biggest criticism, or the biggest critic of him, was someone who used to be a member of the committee in the LTDA anyway. It was John Kennedy, who nicknamed him Silent Bob, obviously.
Mad John. No, I mean, John Kennedy, I know John Kennedy. John's all right. John's a very, very well-meaning individual. He gets quite vociferous. I mean, since he left us, he was involved with the RMT, I believe. I think has he fallen out with him? I don't know. He's retired from the cab trade. I mean, John is no fool. I don't see eye to eye with John. Well, I mean, the first thing that me and John fell out with many years ago was computer cab. John was a big supporter of Jeff Cayley and the boys at ComCab, and so, you know, going back to that again, me and him fell out over that. Well, that's certainly, you know, well, that's how we fell out. We've never really fallen out. I don't see him anymore. Last time I saw him, I think we spoke, we was on amenable terms. You know, John's passionate about things, and he tends to, you know, have his say. So,
So given the turmoil within the trade at the moment, with all these different apps launching and you know, the competition from Uber and the increasing competition from Addison Lee, where can you see it all going?
I've always been a passionate believer in the cab trade. It's certainly the cab trade has certainly changed since I came into it. The private hire industry being licensed back in 2000 obviously had a major impact on the work levels as far as the radio circuits and account work were convinced, and that was always going to happen. When they were licensed, that was always going to happen. I see things, the future of the cab trade, I think it will change a bit. I think a lot more of our work will become app-based. But the reality is that as far as the SAP work, the soon as possible work goes, you know, people walk out the door and either use an app or put their hand up. I really can't see that changing much. The work levels have changed. for many things that are nothing to do with the cap trade. And less people move about now during the day because of, you know, information technology. Lots of stuff is emailed, lots of meetings are e-meetings. The tube service in London's got an awful lot better than it was. Anyone who's, any cab drivers listening to this hasn't been on the tube in years, you know, needs to go down the Jubilee line and see how many, you know, tens of thousands of people are moving around on it all day long. So that's going to have an impact on our work. But I think things change. Best example I can think of is when the Heathrow Express was first launched. Everybody said, oh, that's it. That's the death of the work at the airport, and we're all finished. And it certainly took some work away from us at the airport. But what it did, it turned Paddington, which was a provincial little quiet backwater of a station, into the, I think it's either the busiest or second busiest station in Europe. I think Waterloo's the biggest commuter station, but for constant flow of passengers all day long, I think Paddington's now the biggest, busiest station in Europe. So that wasn't all doom and gloom. Airbus was the main casualty for Heathrow Express. For those who are old enough to remember, the buses used to belong to Airbus. Heathrow Express saw them off. They couldn't compete. They all win. I think the biggest threat facing us is Crossrail. I think Crossrail's going to have an amazing effect. But I think the way that we have to respond to it is we have to be where Crossrail is. You know, it's most of the Crossrail traffic is going to be commuter traffic. We tend not to see anyway. People get the train and get the tube. They'll stay on Crossrail now. But I think we do need to ensure that we have the best ranking facilities available at the key Crossrail stations. The big one I'm thinking of is Liverpool Street. There'll be a major interchange there that we need to ensure we've got the best access to and the best facilities. The apps, I certainly think that Get Taxi and Halo, as it was, certainly started to win back some of the work for us, although there was an argument as to how much they won back. Did they win back a lot of work for minicabs, or was a lot of it street house that were converted into e-house? And undoubtedly some of it was that, but I think generally speaking the amount of work they did bring back was positive, and it was more than was converted. And we, as I say, they've just launched this Maxi app, this new sharing app. You know, I'm still relatively positive. I think the other thing that's changed in the taxi trade is hours. When I first started driving a cab, the department stores all opened at 9 in the morning and closed at 5 in the afternoon. The day has just all moved on now. Everything starts much, much later and finishes much, much later. Whereas it used to get busy 11 o'clock on a Friday and a Saturday night, now it doesn't really get going until gone midnight. And whereas it used to be on its final legs at sort of 3 o'clock,
it's now 5 or 6 o'clock,
exactly. And so undoubtedly there's going to have to be some desire to change. Paul, hello. Oh, so he's on the inside. Paul. Undoubtedly there's the things are going to change. We need to see that this is the biggest difference from when I first started driving a cab to now, the way I see it is the change in the tariffs. At one point a day, if you worked at night, you got 60p, was it? I can't remember now. It's 90p, wasn't it?
60p, and then it's
80 or 90? You can't remember either.
I can't remember.
But, I mean, anyone listening to this now who doesn't know, I mean, it was quite amazing. For working at 3 o'clock in the morning, you worked on exactly the same tariff as you did at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, with either 60 or 80p extras. Yes.
Yeah.
Which always seemed like madness to me, you know, absolute crazy. And the very first thing that we did when we met the new mayor, when the mayor took over Transport for London and it from the carriage office, was the mayor was Ken Livingstone, and we sat down with him and said, look, we need a night tariff and you know, get more cabs out at night, and Livingstone was very, very receptive, you know, and we changed the tariffs and there's been no looking back. And it's quite interesting. People criticise Livingstone. I mean, I've heard theories now that it was all part of some conspiracy to put the price of cabs up. Oh, no, rubbish. The reality was you couldn't get a cab at night. He put the fares up and all of a sudden you could get a cab at night. It was rubbish. And the reality is that tariff-free, we still charge less than most minicab firms and most touts. If anything, I think that we need to review the tariffs again and possibly put more emphasis on an evening and a night tariff, certainly a night tariff, to just encourage more guys out there when there is unmet demand.
So in some quarters, with some passengers, the taxi trade's got quite a bad image at the moment. And I think a lot of it's got to do with TfL's lowering of our standards with regards to testing of vehicles and things like that. I mean, what's your view on that, Steve?
My view on that is I'm not one of these guys who arcs back to the good old days of the carriage office when you used to take a cab up there and you could tell by the look on the guy's face who walked out whether the cab was going to pass or fail. And even if the cab failed, having spent £1,500 on it for your overall, then you went and spent another £300 getting it fixed, took it back and it failed on something else. I was never an avid supporter of that. I mean, I can remember all the overalls I had over the years. Every overall used to start with a handbrake compensator felt. Well, I don't know what handbrake compensator felt is, but I've never had one since, so I think that just about sums it up.
Handbrake compensator felt was on an old fairway. It was on the old handbrake system, which you haven't got on the new ones anyway.
Right, well, I bought a few compensator felts over the years. I mean, and many garages just show it as a scam. You know, this chassis washing and chassis painting. They used to get underneath and inspect the paint. And then all it was an MOT. It was a glorified MOT. And what we've got now, we've got an MOT and the cab either passes or fails.
Having seen it from both sides of the fence, as a driver who used to pay for overalls like that, and from the garage owner that's seen cabs since, the state of taxis now, the standard of taxis has really fallen.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, I don't see it. I'm not crawling about under cabs. You might be. Obviously, you might see it. I mean, the cabs are still on the road. You still see dirty cabs. Most of the taxi cabs you used to see, from my experience, were fleet cabs. They weren't mushers cabs. And most people I know, and I think most cab drivers, it's like I always get given the example of the guy with the tattoos and the string vest. Well, if you see one of them a year, you do see them. It is the odd one here and there, but the majority of guys dress reasonably well.
Yeah.
You know, you might have a pair of jeans on, and you know, like you just say, you've got a pair of jeans and a polo shirt. You look fine to me to drive a cab. Being a suit and tie, but so people always criticise the exceptions, and yeah, I'm sure there are still filthy cabs out there and filthy guys driving them. The majority of cabs I see are reasonably clean, and the guys reasonably presentable.
So, what do you think the trade can do to improve its image further, Steve?
Improve its image. I think we've got I got criticised for this recently. This is another one. It's quite amazing things you get criticised for. I did a GLA inquiry, and one of the things they asked is about the knowledge. They're saying, is it a barrier to entry to the cab trade? The thing with the knowledge is a lot of regulators, a lot of people involved, councillors and people, don't understand it. They're of the opinion that, you know, you could do it equally well with a sat-nav. Of course, anyone who's ever done the knowledge and anyone who drives in London with a sat-nav knows you couldn't.
Yeah.
And you've only got to look at the standard of the minicab trade. And the bedrock of our gold standard is the knowledge. The one thing that we've got to stop anyone interfering with or getting to is the knowledge. I think, to be fair to the current incumbents at TfL, they're fully aware, certainly that this mayor's very aware with the affection or whatever you want to call it, that we hold the knowledge in this trade. So I don't think it's going to be anyone's going to be trying to change it, although you've got to watch it all the time. And these councillors I went to were saying, is it a barrier to entry? It only used to take 12 months back in 1960, 68 or whatever. Yeah, well, everyone who did it in 1960 did it full time. There was no one-way streets. There was 10 restaurants in London. Canary Wharf wasn't there. It was a totally different city. You know, here we are in 2014. I mean, how many five-star, how many Michelin stars restaurants are there in London? Hundreds.
I think when I did it, I started the knowledge 25 years ago, I got my base 23 years ago, just over. It took me 21 months to do it. I think the average time then was 2.5 years. And I was speaking to Courtney Connell the other week, and he said he's starting to get people that are really committed to doing it going through in just over 2 years now.
Yeah, if you're doing it full time, you can do it in 2 years again. I mean, there's other guys taking 10 years. They're going out on a Saturday afternoon and once a month. It's going to take 10 years. That's no excuse to change it. The reality is, it serves a purpose. It ensures that we have this gold standard. It ensures a commitment. It ensures a.
They can have their character checked by their normal knowledge as well, because.
Yeah, the whole, you know, all these people saying that we need to review the knowledge. Having said that, I do think there's a few things on the knowledge that could change. I mean, I don't quite understand this current thing with this with the suburbs testing. Well, I don't know if you know how it works now, but
no. Well,
when you and I did it, and anyone listening to this who's old will remember, when you got your rec, the guy would say, "I'll come back next Tuesday for your suburbs," and you'd have a list of sort of 40 suburban runs, and as long as you knew that sort of, you know, Enfield was up the A10 and Richmond and was down the A3 and the 316, and Bexley was up the A2. You sort of, but now there's 420 suburban runs, and they have to come back. I think it's 3 months. I mean, it's madness. That is something that could be reviewed.
When I did it, there was 128 suburban runs, and I think it was 2 weeks or something like that.
That's reasonable. But at the moment, it's some of them are running at 3 months to do the suburbs, and it's just crazy because the fact that I know that. You know, that Loughton High Road becomes Woodford High Road becomes Woodford Road or whatever it is. I'm never going to remember that. I only know it because I lived there, we used to. And so why would you be testing people on that? The suburban knowledge testing should be, where's Loughton? You go through Walthamstow, through Woodford into Loughton. That's what it should be. It shouldn't be that you have to know every little break in the road all the way through and that Woodford Green starts here. And it's crazy. And that is something that does need looking at. We could certainly knock three months off the knowledge that way without any dilution of the standards that we need in the central London, the standards, you know, as they are and should be kept. So there are ways it could be tweaked, and I favour tweaking the suburban testing. And what it's become a sort of map-selling thing for some of the knowledge schools, isn't it? They sell all these suburban runs and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now it's added 3 months onto the knowledge, and if you don't spend 50 quid on the books, you can't pass it.
I think the other thing that's mad is, will they have to go away and wait for their badge to turn up in the post?
Oh, no, they're going to change that. That's one of the things we raised from a few months ago. When they moved it, for TLPH are now moving to Faith Lawson House. What they're going to do when they get there, and I was on the phone to them earlier, they're going to reintroduce the introductory talk by an examiner, and they're going to reintroduce the passing out parade. The passing out thing. So what happens is every Friday there'll be a passing out ceremony. So the only downside is if you get your badge on a Monday, if you pass on a Monday, you've got to wait till the Friday to get your badge. But 4 days, I think we can do. As opposed to this situation they had at the moment where they post them out and it's all not very secure and it's just not very good. To be fair, TFL, these are the sorts of things we talk to them about all the time, and that's what they're listening to.
Are they going to reintroduce a counter service for drivers?
They are going to reintroduce a counter service. The only thing they're not going to do, they're not going to be able to take cash. And once again, I think you can see their point. We live in a pretty much cashless society. The moment they introduce taking cash, they've got to have a cash handling system. The whole world gets involved and complicated. They've got to get security code. So they won't be doing that, but certainly if you you'll be able to go there, get the forms, fill them in.
So mentioning cash and obviously credit card payments and things like that, are you of the opinion that every driver should accept credit cards?
Am I of the opinion, a personal opinion? I think anyone, if I was driving a cab full time, I'd certainly take credit cards. I just can't think of any reason why you wouldn't. Should it be mandated? No, it shouldn't. Why should somebody force you to give credit? I can understand all the reasons for taking credit cards, and I think most guys, as time goes on, will begin to, more and more people will accept them. But I think mandating credit cards is just another tier of regulation we don't need.
I'm of the opinion we shouldn't need to be forced. We should accept it anyway.
Which is what will happen. Yeah. I think what's going to happen, the biggest thing, is this new... what they call it, iPay thing, where people are going to touch their phones. I think that's going to be massive. That's going to take off. And what's going to happen is you get more and more people getting the cab expecting to be able to pay with that.
Yeah.
And so at the end, you're going to be running around cash machines and so it will just be a natural progression.
So taxi newspapers, Steve, used to be owned by the LTDA, didn't it?
Yep.
It's no longer owned by the
LTDA. No, it is. It's totally owned by
the
LTDA.
It's just managed by a company, though.
Yeah, no, we've got total editorial control over it. The only thing we do is the way it's set up, the advertising, the way that we used to do everything ourselves. And what we do now, we've got a publisher, and he's got so many pages in it to sell for advertising, and then he pays us a set amount every month for the paper, and he prints the paper, and we do all the editorial. We do all the editorial control. We've also got total editorial control over the adverts and everything else. It's just that instead of us selling the advertising space ourselves, and dealing with the bad debts and dealing with all the hassle, we've employed a professional to do it. They do the layout. They set the sort of style. This is what these people do. And the thing about taxi newspaper is, as a lot of people see it, other than cab drivers, you'd be amazed at the people on our mailing list, people who subscribe to it. Many MPs. Certainly, you know, the whole of the GLA. People you'd be amazed that subscribe to it.
So how many copies are printed?
We print a minimum of 17,000 copies. Some issues, like this current issue, we printed 21. This is the demo issue. We've got people handing it out at the moment. We've got people at railway stations handing it out. And the reason that we've done this deal with the publishers is we guarantee a set amount of money for it every month.
So, you know, you've got regular income from it.
We've got regular income from it. It's not that we need the income, it's just that we know where we are with it. And we're guaranteed to print this many papers at this quality.
So you say you've got full editorial control over the adverts.
Yep.
Obviously slipped up
yep.
the advert on the
Verifone. Yep. Complete and utter cock-up. Editor should have seen it and never saw it. He was sent it and didn't read it. Well, he did read it, but he speed-read it. He just thought it was another. And missed the crucial copy. We were gutted when we saw that. Absolutely gutted.
You put an apology out.
Yeah, we put an apology out. But I mean, Barry Hooper was very vociferous against it. We spoke to the editor about it. It certainly won't happen again. And indeed, I mean, Verifone issued an apology over it. I mean, the guy who did it, certainly don't think his promotion prospects at Verifone are too good. It was a cock-up. That's just, you know, hands up.
So what's your opinion of, you know, all of the trade associations, the LTDA included?
Oh, hang on, I'll tell you a better one. About 18 months, 2 years ago, the papers come through, it comes through with blank pages, you know, with the adverts blanked out. If they're regular adverts, they're blanked out. We only see the new adverts, because once they've been approved, we see them. And an insurance company that we'd run an advert before, we presumed it would be the same taxi insurance company. And it was a great big advert for minicab insurance. And because the publishers never picked up on the difference. And so we printed 17,000 copies with a big minicab advert in it. And fortunately, the first guy in the morning spotted it. And we got more back. And we had to mulch a lot. 17,000 copies mulched. That was a bigger cock up, but no one knew about that one.
As I said, all the trade organisations, and I think the LTDA included, all get into this, fall into this problem of slagging each other off.
Never seen me slag anyone off.
I've never seen you personally slag anyone off.
You won't find me slag anybody.
Other members of the Com have done, other members of Taxi Newspaper have done within the pages.
Not certainly in the last 3 years they haven't, since I've had the job.
There was one in the last month.
What was in their last month? Who was that?
It was either Richard Massey or Barry Hooper slagging off. They didn't name someone.
Who was he slagging off?
Internet trolls.
Well, that's not a group, is it, to be fair? I mean,
if you read into it, you could tell exactly. I mean, it's not me. It wasn't aimed at me.
I mean, if that's Barry's view, but I mean, what he certainly didn't do, he certainly didn't slag off any of the other trade groups by name. He certainly never slagged off, LCDC, Unite, yeah. RMT, UCG, or anything.
So you're trying to put a stop to it.
I know I've put a stop to it. We don't do that. It doesn't achieve anything. All that infighting is all very, very negative.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, it's very, very tempting to respond to, especially when a lot of it's just rubbish and completely wrong. You do sort of think, well, I should put it right and I should have a go back. But no, I don't think it should. I certainly don't think drivers want to see it. And so, you know,
I don't think it does any good for the image of the LCDA anyway.
No, we don't do it. As I said, we don't do it. I mean, I can't remember.
I mean, the last big one I can remember is the Benny one about John Kennedy.
Yeah, I mean,
which I found quite amusing.
Well, I don't think he thought it was funny. I mean, that was at least 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, we don't do that anymore. It doesn't go on. And sometimes it doesn't go on in the face of quite sort of, you know, vociferous, aggressive attacks on us. We don't respond.
So a lot of people would ask, what's Bob's involvement with the LTDA now?
Yeah, I mean, Bob's the Deputy General Secretary. He's still a very active member of the COM. He's, you know, as I said, people who don't know Bob, who have him down as this silent guy who sits in the corner and says nothing. Sorry, it's not that. Is certainly not the case. He's got a lot to say on most things. He knows an awful lot about many things. You know, he came second. We had an election recently, you know, again, a rigged election, apparently. All our elections are done by the Electoral Reform Society. We get about a third of members respond, which is about what it is at a general election. You know, you get the form through the post, some third of guys fill it in, two-thirds straight away. I mean, then I said, oh, I should have put something in the paper to remind them. You know, I sent them a post. The Electoral Reform Society sent them a form through the post. If they don't want to fill it in, me putting something in the paper ain't going to make them fill it in. Because... You see, I take that as an endorsement because the way I view it is if I was particularly upset about something and felt particularly badly, then I would vote. Whereas if I'm reasonably okay and I think, you know, or I'm happy, then I don't respond. So that's how I see that. I think if it was if the majority, why would we be putting members on if the majority of guys weren't happy? They'd be leaving, and they're not leaving. As I keep saying to you, we're putting members on. So some of the stuff you read on the internet, you know, is laughable, really. I mean, some of the statements that are put on there. I mean, I saw one the other day that we count knowledge boys. I mean, it's not rocket science. All you've got to do is get a copy of our accounts. They're on the internet. You know what the subs are. Divide the income by the subs, and you've worked out the membership. It's not hard, you know, but they'll say, oh, no, you've only counted knowledge boys. No, we're not. I mean, and Knowledge Associate Scheme isn't even on our membership system. It's on some ancient Access or early version of Excel. That's not the case. You know, every single member we count. We don't even count members. You get a month free when you join under certain deals. We don't count them until they're paid. And as I said to you, our membership figure at the moment, our AGM... which we had a month ago, which was given the figures for the end of last year. I think the official figure was 10.3. And today, I think our official figure is about 10.5 and a bit, or 10.550. But, of course, the reality is it's probably 100 more than that. But we don't. People are sick and they're not paying subs. We don't count them. you know, people have only just joined. They're not paying. People with other financial difficulties, they're not paying. We don't count them. So... You know, our membership's what it is, and I know that sticks in a lot of them people's throats, but that's just how it is. It's just that's it. Yeah. And the other one I heard was, when people leave, you still count them. No, I don't. People leave, you're off that month. If you don't pay, we don't count you, let alone if you leave.
Three more questions for you. The UTG.
UTG, United Trucks. I lose track of who we are. We're the UTG, aren't we?
UTG.
Yep.
Do you see it has any future?
I can't see why it wouldn't. I mean, we're the three biggest groups in the trade. I speak to Grant on a daily basis. That's how I rang him this morning, got his voicemail. He rang me back just now, missed him. And I speak to Jim or Peter Rose or Dynamite Mike Edges. I speak to I speak to him certainly once a week. I certainly speak to people in the RMT. The thing with the RMT is, as you said earlier, there is a bit of history there, us slagging them off and them slagging us off, to be fair. But I think we've both moved through that pretty much.
Do you ever see a point where the RMT and UCG possibly would be involved?
Definitely. Definitely.
I think that would appease nearly the whole trade, Stephen. I think it
it'll appease the whole trade. I mean, what about anybody else who comes along? Do we say, Tony, you've got 10 members, and do I? It's a but no. I'll speak to Mick Bailey every time I see him. I've met him a few times. The more vociferous, aggressive members of the RMT that were digging us out, that's pretty much sort of stopped now.
Yeah.
But having said that, I'm not a one-man band. I'm driving a busload of people here, so I can't make them all go where I want. I mean, I might be the driver, but not everybody sees it that way yet. But people, they're gradually coming round, and that's not just within the LTDA. That's within Unite and the LCDC as well. They certainly see. And what doesn't help is when you see these personal attacks on people. To be fair, I'm very rarely the subject of it. Not that I give them monkeys anyway, but I'm very rarely the subject of it. But when you see these personal attacks on people, you can understand why people don't want to deal with them. No one likes being dug out, especially some of the stuff that's said, not just about members of the LTDA, as I said, about other people as well. I mean, I saw some stuff about some LCDC people a couple of weeks ago. Blatantly not true. Yeah. Absolutely blatantly not true, and yet these people repeat it on the internet as if it's gospel, and you think, well, I can see why. And then the next meeting they say, just, oh, why don't you talk to us? Well, it's very difficult because one hand you're saying this and now you want to talk,
so that's one of the reasons for doing these podcasts, Steve, because you get to talk to people and you can hear the emotion in people's voices rather than the written word that comes across somewhat differently sometimes.
Yeah, I've listened to a few of yours now since I spoke. Yeah, no, it's obviously it's better if we all talk to each other. What the first thing I did was stop the slagging off. We don't slag each other. Well, we certainly don't slag anybody off. I've certainly been the subject of some slagging off in the trade press, but we don't respond to it. So we put a stop to that. It's certainly not coming from this side. I know someone's nagging somebody, but anyone who finds anything, let me know, because I don't see it. I mean, so you're saying Barry mentioned internet trolls. Well, internet trolls, there's LTDA members who are internet trolls, LCDC, Unite and RMT members who are internet trolls. And
you used the term in the wrong thing. You used the phrase in the wrong term anyway. Did it, well, that's not really
But we don't slag people off. We do still get slagged off. Often wrongly, and to be fair, a lot of it I don't even read anymore. I mean, you get criticised for stuff, and in the end, you think, well, what's the point? We'll do our best. If we get something wrong, I'll put my hands up and say we got it wrong. I mean, the biggest thing we got wrong was that nighttime Olympic fairs. It was put to a vote. We got the people up here. I voted against it. I lost. And somebody, people thought it'd be a good idea. And of course, it wasn't. To be fair, I got convinced it would be a good idea. And of course, it wasn't. The Olympics were the biggest disaster ever to hit London, as we know. Unfortunately, we never had the Olympic fairs, so it was a negative anyway. But I think that was the last mistake that we made.
Yeah.
And the last time that we were pretty much out of touch. I like to think that we've got a finger on the pulse with most things, certainly as far as the touting goes, certainly as far as everything that's pretty much happening with TFL, Uber. Once again, I'm constantly being given advice on what we should have done with Uber. You should have done this, you should have done that. And the one I'm constantly told, this is the one that makes me laugh, take TFL to court. That's what I'm constantly told. For what do I take them to court for? And then you pick these sort of, barrack room lawyers, read a little bit about natural justice or statutory duties and all of that. When you speak to the lawyers, it's complete rubbish, absolute trash. You can't do that. You've got very specific grounds and reasons for doing it. You can't just pop up at a court and say, I want to take TFL. Now, why don't you spend some money on that one? And the other one is, and this is the one this week, why don't we promote the trade more in trade magazines or in sorry, national papers or day? Great idea, brilliant idea. The last advert we took out in the Standard, which was the Theresa May one over the DBR, another criticism, we should have gone for TFL and not Theresa May. Well, only because of us going for Theresa May did the DBS reform their system and get it turned around so that they've all been turned around in 6 weeks instead of 4 months. So that was another criticism that we had. But when we took that Theresa May campaign out, criticising her for the failure of the DBS and guys being out of work, we took adverts, full-page adverts in the Standard, full-page adverts in the Metro, and we had a lot of electronic billboards. The billboards are not as much money as you might think. I think we spent $60,000 on billboards, £60,000. It's reasonable value for money. But the Standard and the Metro, I think it was $50,000. Full-page advert in the Metro and a full-page advert in the Standard. I think we had an edition and a half. That I can't quite remember the detail, but basically it was $50,000. So
doesn't go a long way, does it?
It doesn't go a long way. And some people sort of think, you know, we should not advertise the cab trade. Well,
so with this ultra-low emission zone proposal.
ULEZ.
Yeah.
Age limit. And that's my fault as well. We've got a 15-year age limit. Let me tell you what happened there. All the figures, all the statistics, everything TFL had, we employed our own scientists, got some really top-notch scientists, we've just spoken to them again recently, different people but from the same organisation, to review all TFL's figures, to review all the air quality monitoring sites, to review everything. And these guys are proper scientists, they're bow ties a lot. And basically what they said was TFL's figures are pretty right. There's a few bits and plate areas they're wrong, some of their projections is a bit vague, but roughly they're right. And the reality was that the standard at the time, the new standard at the time, was Euro 5. We still had cabs on the road that were Euro 1, Euro 3. Livingston had been given the same problem 4 years earlier. Livingston's solution was to let us have these retrofit exhaust systems in order not to impose an age limit. If you remember, they cost anything between, I think the cheapest one's about £1,000. I paid £1,000 for mine. £1,000 to £1,300. And then he put 20 pence on the extra, 20 pence on every job. If you do 20 jobs a day, I know these guys, I work the airport, I don't do 20 jobs a day, but there are plenty of guys out there who do 20 jobs a day. You work out over the course of a year, you got your money back. Plus, you didn't get an age limit. You got to keep the cap. The current incumbent, Boris, saw it differently. Boris thought the only way to do it and to do it quickly was to get these Euro 3 cabs off the road and to get Euro 5 cabs on the road. And they had very, very compelling evidence and very good examples of why only a 10-year age limit would have done that. Fortunately for us, the scientists we employed and something that we spotted up here was all of their figures were based on the cabs they took off the road vanishing. So a 10-year-old cab taken off the road, it's just gone. It's completely destroyed. It ceases to be. It's not putting out any more pollutants. And it's replaced with a new cab that's putting out Euro 5. What we managed to work out was that a 10-year-old cab wouldn't have gone off the road. A 10-year-old cab would have simply succumbed it to private usage. People would have bought them as second cars, dog walkers, you know, people running the kids to the school. And so they would still have been on the road. Sure, they wouldn't have been doing the cab average of 22,000 mile a year, but they would have been doing 12,000 mile a year. So we re-got the figures done, whereby the cabs weren't vanishing, they were staying on the road at 12,000 mile a year, plus the new cabs coming on in addition to that. We were able to prove the benefit in a 10-year age limit was far, far less than TFL had predicted, and therefore the difference between the 10 and the 15-year age limit was much less, and therefore Boris was going to decimate the cab fleet, all the hardships, all the bits, for a very little benefit, not this massive benefit that they'd foreseen. That was the chink in their armour. We got that, we were able to convince them of that, and they went with 15 years. And 15 years, as you know, in reality is 16 years. It's not great, but it's a lot better than 10 years, and that's what we were honestly faced with. And anyone who sold you, we should have just told them no. Well, yeah, tell them no and have a 10-year age limit. So I view that as a great victory, that one, and I'll argue that one with anyone because I was there, very involved with that. We were very lucky.
The reality is there wasn't that many cabs on the road over 16 years.
No, there wasn't. Mostly. And most of them were at fleet cabs.
Yeah.
And I know people saying, well, it's now a shortage of cab and you can't rent a cab. 10 years would have been a lot, lot worse.
That's not due to the age limit. That's due to LTI going down the pan and the lack of cabs being produced.
ULEZ, they're talking about 2020 bringing in a ULEZ, which is going to be a congestion charge. They're talking about making it a Euro 6 standard for diesel, Euro 4 for petrol. Petrol's much cleaner, as we know. We think the mayor's wrong. We think the mayor's putting all his eggs in the Euro 6 basket, exactly like he did with Euro 5, and Euro 5 didn't work. Euro 5 is the DPFs, the diesel particulate filters. On a motorway, they're great. They regenerate, they burn off, no problem. When these things regenerate Hyde Park Corner, they put out NO2, nitrous dioxide, very poisonous. And they also, the PMs, the little particulates that come out of the exhaust, Euro 3 used to put out PM10s, which are quite big bits. And the standard, what happened with Euro 5, it started producing PM2.5, much smaller ones, which are much more dangerous, get further in your lungs, and even smaller ones than that. They're microscopic, and that's what's causing the danger now. Euro 5 didn't work. Euro 5 has caused us major problems with air quality, much more so than predicted. And incidentally, that's another thing. There's a campaign group out there, Boris, Cabbies Against Boris, which as far as I can figure out is Alan Fleming, who incidentally was the guy who used to hand out the leaflets telling people to vote for Boris. Remember the Vote Boris receipts? He now runs Cabbies Against Boris with a guy called Dave Davis, who's not a cab driver, who's an exhaust manufacturer. And so what they're saying now is that the age limit was wrong, and we shouldn't have had the age limit, and they're probably right. The reality is they are probably right. Euro 5 is doing more damage, because it's very difficult to criticise them, because at the time that the decisions were made, they thought Euro 5 was going to work. Of course, now it's turned out it hasn't, but they didn't know that. And so they're saying to me last week, why didn't you support our demonstration against cabs against Boris? We're going around telling everyone that the new cabs on the road are dirtier than the old ones, and we're putting out more pollutants. Do I really want to be popping up on the telly and the radio telling Londoners that I'm killing them? I just saw that as a no-brainer. There was no benefit. There was absolutely no chance the age limit was going to be revoked.
Yeah.
So the benefit to it was what? Telling people we're polluting. Euro 6, the ULEZ, ultra low emission zone, congestion charge zone, Euro 6 diesel, Euro 4 petrol. What we think the mayor should do, and we've teamed up with Clean Air London, is what we think the mayor should do, he should impose a complete diesel ban on non-commercial diesels in the congestion zone. So obviously taxis and delivery vehicles would be exempt. But if you want to buy a diesel car, you can't bring it into London. And you've got a choice. You don't have to buy a diesel vehicle. You can buy a petrol one if you want to come into London. And then what we say would have happened is overnight, like from the moment he'd announced it, and he should have announced it 6 months ago, anyone who's looking at buying a car from here on in is only going to buy a petrol car or a hybrid or an electric, which is much, much better anyway. And then what would have happened by 2020, 5 years down the line, and then what they could have done with the ULEZ, they could have said, well, for the first year, if you want to bring a diesel car and it's £5 a day or £8 a day on top of the congestion charge, and then gradually increase it as the years went on. The majority of cars in London are relatively new anyway. It's a relatively prosperous city. I think the average age limit for a car in London is just 6.8 years. So it wouldn't have had that much of a hardship. And that would have been the way to do it. That would clean up the air. That would ensure the taxis certainly can't get, at the moment, electric or petrol lorries or big vans, it doesn't work. And what we're saying is that he should do that. He should also, there's not a single rapid charge point within 6 miles of Charing Cross, not one. He should be investing in rapid charge points to encourage people to buy electric. And then what can happen with the ULEZ is, which is, and as the taxi fleet is naturally replaced with firstly Euro 6, and then more importantly 2 or 3 years down the line with hybrids. Which are the LCC are developing one, Nissan have got this electric one, and the Metro Cab are developing it, and no one knows what Mercedes are doing, but I'm sure they're working on it. We'd see a natural progression to cleaner vehicles. That's the way to do it.
So do you think the taxi trade will get an exemption from the ULEZ?
Yeah, that's the big battle at the moment. We're constantly meeting with the mayor's air quality advisors, and that's obviously our argument.
I mean, it puts anyone that's looking to buy a new cab at the moment in a bit of a quandary,
yep.
Because apparently LTC have said that their Euro 6 doesn't come out until next September.
That's right.
So,
Euro 6 comes out next September. Nissan are bringing their electric one out March next year. Allegedly, they're going to launch end of this month, no, in September, but beginning of October. That's petrol, so that'll be clean. Euro 6 LTC end of next year.
I think Nissan have just said December.
Yeah, they're sending the first ones in December. I've got an invite to a launch in, I think it's in October sometime, somewhere. Well, of course, that might be moved back on. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, either way, that's going to be Petrolasm when it's launched. Metro Cab, allegedly, is going to be doing real passenger trials. They're going to be licensed as actual working cabs. Well, supposed to have happened last Monday. So whether, yeah, but next Monday, the Monday after, who knows?
So given all the problems that we face, do you think the trade's got a future?
Yeah, I think the trade's got a very secure future. I think there's always going to be a need and a demand for the services we provide, the top end of the market, the quality end of the market. I think what we need to do, we need to keep up in our game as far as technological bits are concerned, as apps and anything else that we can adopt that gives us a foothold. I think what's going to happen now, I think the minicab industry, the certain fractions of the minicab industry led by Uber are going to be constantly racing to the bottom price-wise. I saw another one launched today, bidforyourfare.co.uk minicab app. You know, you bid for the, you tell them where you're going and they all bid for the cheapest fare. This sort of race to the bottom. Uber recently had a demonstration in New York from Uber drivers fed up with the prices being forced down. We've certainly been contacted by several Uber drivers wanting to know how they could set up an Uber drivers group and offer any assistance that we could offer them, because they're fed up with their prices being forced down and being forced to sort of scurry around trying to earn a living. As I say, I think there'll be a two-tier system, but much more defined than it is at the moment. I think what you'll find us and the reasonably high-end private hire vehicles, you know, the sort of Addison Lees and better of this world will pretty much be as we are. But I think the cheaper end of the minicab industry will, it won't implode, but it can only force prices down to such a level where they're cutting costs, cutting services, and it will become a real second-class system.
So what for the LTDA? What's in the future for the LTDA?
LTDA future. As I said to you, we're putting on more and more members. We're offering a better and better service. We've just recently employed another ex-policeman up here, a guy who was actually retired from the old bill to come and work for us. He bit of an expert on traffic law, certainly an expert on what goes on in the centre of London. He's a policeman in the centre of London, so we're able to offer penalty charge notices, all of that sort of stuff, the CCTV offences. We're able to offer a world-class service on that. Anybody gets involved and needs a lawyer for something criminal, we defend you. That's it. There's no question of it. You're a member of ours, you're in trouble, we defend you. We're providing more and more services like that. We're also now starting to offer more and more ancillary benefits, if you like. We've recently signed a deal up with, you've got this LTDA Plus thing, which I was a bit sceptical of, these sort of things you have to join and then you get benefits. But, I went to Gran Canaria early in the year and saved £500. Found the holiday for a travel agent online, got the holiday, phoned up the number they give you with the package deal booking. I picked it, £500 off. That more of those sorts of services that we can offer. We've recently set up a deal, in the process of setting a deal up with Virgin. You get 10% off with Virgin on those sorts of member benefits, that, just a bonus to being a member. It's not the reason you become a member, but it's the bonus. I mean, our subs are £16.80 a month. The tax man lets you claim £12.80 of it against tax, so it's like that all day long. The non-taxable bit is £4 a month, so it's costing you £1 a week, and then depending on what level of tax you pay, what you can claim back, it's probably costing you £3 a week to be a member of the LTDA, probably less. Our subs haven't gone up in, is it 12 or 13 years? I can't remember. It's a long time. Probably 13.
It hasn't gone up by much, because it was 15.80 when I joined.
Yeah, well, it hasn't gone up in, it might be 13 years, might be. It's a long time, our subs out, and we've got no intentions of putting our subs up. We don't need to. The more members we get, the more benefits that those sorts of things that we can offer. Also, politically, it gives us more clout. I was at, as I said to you earlier, I was at the GLA the other day, and one of the GLA councillors said, well, you've only got 10,500 members. He said, there's 22,500 councillors. And the sort of implication was that, you know, that I corrected him on, that was that there's 12,000 guys out there, 13,000, who disagree with us. And of course, I used to point out to him, no, that's not the case. The fact that someone is not a member doesn't mean they disagree with any of our policies. I can't think of a single policy of ours that most cab drivers would disagree with. It's just that they don't have to join, and they haven't, and that's their choice, and long may it stay that way. But it doesn't mean that they disagree with us, because they don't.
So if someone wants to join the LCDA, how do they get in touch?
You can do it on our website, www.ltda.co.uk. You can ring us, people ring us all day long. You can email us, it's all on the website, or just come in reception. And as I said to you, you know, I envisage the time, if we keep growing at this rate, let's call it 500 members a year, this time next year, I anticipate, you know, we'll be over 11,000 members. 4 or 5 years' time, we'll certainly have half the traders members, certainly half of the traders working as members. Which is all got to be good.
Well, thanks very much, Steve. That's been
great. I'll deal with all your phone calls now.
So there you go, a great interview with Steve McNamara. Don't forget, you can now download the Supercabby podcast from supercabby.co.uk, or you can subscribe to it in your favourite podcast app on your mobile device. Also, if you do like the podcast, please go to iTunes and leave a review. It just helps us to get the podcast viewable to more people that might want to listen. Anyway, until next week, that's all from me. See you again. Bye-bye.